welcome to this episode of Better Off Red. This is episode 132. This is Pip Adam. Did I say that? Can't remember. Anyway, very grateful to have you listening. This is the first episode in the new series that we're putting together. We being me, my guests, and you. There we go. Finally, we've got a we. In this episode, I get to talk to Whiti Hiriaka. In this series, what I'm doing is speaking to writers about where they're at. So I ask them to bring in an object which they're using at the moment for, the part of the process that they're at. I think, as I said in the spoiler at the beginning, I thought this would be a very straightforward thing of beginning, middle, end. But I think, I'm gonna lean more into beginning-ish, middle-ish, and end-ish. So, in this podcast, Whiti describes where she's at with the project that she's working on at the moment. I really hope you enjoy the series, and thank you so much, as always, for listening, and thank you for the people who financially contribute. I'm having a bit of trouble with that word today, I don't know why. Thanks to everyone, and especially a huge thanks to Whiti, because, it was just an amazing podcast. Thank you so much, Whiti. Kia ora, Whiti. How are you?
Kia ora, Pip. I'm well. How are you?
I'm really good, yeah. It's a Friday night.
Friday.
All right. In the big city. It's a bit grey.
It is really grey, actually.
Super grey.
But that's okay.
Yeah.
Spend the weekend reading. That'd be lovely.
I love spring in Wellington.
The several springs of Wellington.
Shit time. Yeah, it's got to be good. Awesome. First of all, thank you so much for coming to be on the podcast. Very excited to talk to you. I just wonder, could we start with you introducing yourself however you would like to introduce yourself?
Sure.
Completely up to you.
Tēnā koe. Ko Whiti Hiriaka ho. Ko kaituhi me kaia ko o tuhituhi aho. Yeah, that's probably it. Kia ora, I'm Whiti. I'm a writer and I teach writing.
Awesome. Man, that's a good combination of things, I think.
I think so.
Yeah.
It's okay. I'm going to touch some wood. It's okay at the moment.
We're all meddling. No, got some wood. We got some wood. So in this series, what I'm asking people to do is to sort of describe where they're up to in a project.
Mm.
And just for today and just how you want to, where are you up to?
Yeah. Well, today's quite, I guess, fortuitous to be here. So I started writing my next novel in July, mm-hmm. and today I've hit the halfway point, sort of. I was aiming to write 90,000 words for this first draft. I've hit 45,000, but I don't think I'm actually halfway through writing the draft, but I'm celebrating anyway, so yay!
I think it's always worth celebrating.
I think so.
How did you come up with that number of words?
My last novel, Karangaituku, was around about that length, but also I'm writing this novel as part of my PhD.
Awesome.
And so the kind of full length of my thesis needs to be 100,000 words, so 90,000 novel and 10,000 of a kind of critical analysis of, I'm not sure yet, of my writing, of how I write. We'll see when we get there.
Awesome. It's kind of nice to have that framework in there, eh?
Mm.
Like, that must be quite an interesting, I don't know, since I've known you, you've often been writing things for stage, or you've been writing, helping with dance, and sometimes the framework comes from outside, eh?
Very much so.
Yeah.
When I was a full-time writer, I'm doing the kind of air quotes. When I was a full-time writer, it was a lot of chasing other people's projects, basically,
mm-hmm.
Which was great. I love being a gun for hire and jumping into a project that I don't know too much about, but then I can put my own spin on. It's always fun. But yeah, it's nice to be, I guess, helming my own project again.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah, I really like the sound of that. Now, I've also, the other thing I've done, I did, yeah, you're the first, you know that, eh? Like, you're the first person we're doing in
I'm
this
the guinea
series.
Pig.
Yeah, I think it's going
patient
well.
Patient zero.
I think it's going well so far.
I think so.
But yeah. I give myself 10 out of 10. I think we're doing okay. So what I asked is if you could bring along an object of sorts, something that you're using at the moment at this stage of the project. And, yeah, I don't know, have you had a chance to think of something?
I've been thinking about it a lot. And I don't have a physical object, although I sort of do because I am wearing, I bought myself a taonga. It's a ruru that's been carved from a deer antler, and I bought that for to like to celebrate the halfway mark. So I guess that's an object that I'm using at the moment. But what I'm actually going to be talking about is, I guess, the objects that I'm using in the novel. So they don't actually exist outside of the novel. Yet, she says, maybe. So the novel is about an artist, and each part of the novel, each chapter, starts off with a description of a piece of art that she's made for her exhibition. So I guess we could talk about those objects, which don't exist yet, but sort of exist in the novel. And then I was thinking about that further, and there's like a bigger, there's an object holds all of these objects. So she's making this artwork for an exhibition, and her exhibition, you walk into it, it is like an exploded whare. So each part of each painting or thing that she's created is part of this whare. And that whare, see, it's going to get really confusing now. That whare is based on a whare that she dreams of. So that's an imaginary whare that she turns into a real whare, but I'm imagining that whare in the novel, so it doesn't exist. It exists, but it doesn't. And then that whare kind of ties back to Kurangaitoku, so it's the whare that we read about in Te Kore. So, yeah, it does exist and doesn't exist, and, yeah, a very confusing object to talk about, I guess.
But so freaking cool. Oh my gosh, that's really excited me, because I wonder what it is about this object that makes it useful for I sense like we're halfway through the project. It's sort of, you know, in time, you've been working on it for like 3 months or so. Well, thinking, you know, like for July, let's say July. And I'm just interested in how, I imagine that a touchstone like this is really useful when you, I just wonder, I don't want to be as simple as what does it represent, but I just mean, why is this a useful touchstone for this phase of the project, do you think?
Yeah, well, sometimes I'm using the descriptions of these artworks. I create them before I create a chapter, so that kind of springs me into the story of the chapter, like what's going on here, how does this artwork relate to it? And sometimes I'm writing them, like the chapter I'm working on at the moment, I haven't written about the artwork yet, and I'm going back to write about it probably next week. So in that way I'm using the chapter to reflect, I guess, what the artist is thinking of in the object that she's going to create. Yeah. And that this is objects within objects again. So this one will be interesting because she's using love letters that her very bad boyfriend sent her when she was a very young girl. So she's kind of repurposing them for her art. So, yeah, it's the chapter itself is set when they first met, so the letters in that chapter have a different meaning to her, to the art that she's going to create with him. So, yeah, I like kind of like the way it's talking, almost commenting on her life through her art. Yeah, I think that's... So, yeah, it's either inspiring me to get into the chapter or it's a way to reflect on the chapter, which I think is very interesting for my brain. And I'm itching to make some of them, but is that a distraction or not? I'm not sure.
My brain is fizzing. What I really love, and I think it's what I've always loved about your work, right back to the slightly, like, the the books, I don't want to say more conventional because they've always been, you know, experimental and exciting, but I mean, like, Kurangai Tuku is such a, you know, like it is such an object-y book. And I'm just thinking the what you're saying at the moment, it feels like not only are these sort of an imaginative exercise, but they're also something that's helping to structure the object itself, which I think is really interesting.
Yeah. And I guess particularly with Kurangai Tuku, I was interested in the novel as an object. So it's kind of interesting now to go back and making fictional objects within the novel. I don't know where I'll go to next with the use of objects.
Yeah. And I think this is one of the interesting things. It's something I think is really hard, is to write an artist and then write the objects that the artist makes. Because I think sometimes that can be, you know, that can be the downfall of a novel, eh?
Yeah.
I was just thinking about even books about poets. Sometimes that's really hard to write the poetry. But I just feel like you have a wee bit of experience with visual art, say.
A little bit. There was a time when I was a teenager when I was considering, like, art school. Oh, she went art school.
Art school.
it was some secret thing.
Art school confidential. Art school.
Didn't mean to do that. I was really enjoyed creating things. I still enjoy creating things. And, yeah, I love going to galleries and whatnot, being an art wanker. Sorry, all art wankers out there.
We all love it. We love it. Yeah, I'm one. I am Spartacus. Anyway, sorry.
But for me, it's a way to get into the character of Aria. Like, she is the kind of artist that puts herself so much into her art that it seemed strange not to write about what she was creating. And because this is not really a spoiler because it happens at the beginning of the novel at the moment. You might all forget about it by the time the novel comes out anyway. But there's been a big eruption during the opening of her exhibition, and so she's kind of crushed underneath all of her artwork, crushed and saved at the same time. So, yeah, the objects, the artworks themselves then become her company, her characters themselves. Strange not to include them. Whether or not I've done it successfully, you shall see.
I can't imagine anything but. I really like this idea of the exploded fuddy as well.
Yeah.
Like, I saw an exploded house at the Tate Modern once, and it was the freakiest thing I've ever. Like, they had literally blown it up, and then these tiny little splinters had sort of been put around the room. It's quite freaky, this idea of. What I love, and this is totally my, you know, personal rubbish, but, well, not rubbish, something I believe in. But, yeah, this idea of sort of impermanence and, you know, even broken, it can come back together. And, you know, like, it just sounds really, really great structurally.
And I just really like, I'm sort of obsessed with gutters, in graphic novels, I should say. Not in the street.
Or they may
they're
be. Pretty cool.
Maybe. They're great. I love gutters. The idea of gutters, so there's, you know, a time jump almost. There's a gap between. And we as readers make that jump with the frames. So this is almost that too.
Yeah.
I really like going to galleries and seeing the space between works as much as the works themselves. Like, where has a curator decided to put things in relation to other things, and how do they talk to each other? I'm really interested in that.
And where on the walls, kind of even that kind of stuff.
When people walk into the gallery, what is the first piece that hits them, and what is the curator trying to elicit from a viewer by doing that. I just find that fascinating.
Oh, me too. And I love that thing if you ever get to see one set of paintings in more than one gallery. It is quite astounding when sometimes exhibitions come and tour New Zealand and you sort of, just this different idea of what the works are when they're together is kind of quite, I don't know, I find it quite thrilling. And it's kind of, I mean, this kind of where to place what information, I mean, it's quite interesting thinking about returning to the world of kuna ngai tuku. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's quite an interesting thing to sort of reorder some of the ideas that are in there in a different, I don't know, space or time frame, yeah.
Yeah, it's been kind of cool to dip back and think, because the whare and te kore come up quite frequently. So, yeah, going back and using that language in slightly different ways. Mm. So I'm hoping that, I don't know, if these super fans of Kurangai Tuku will see sort of Easter eggs. You don't have to. I'm not saying you have to read that before you read this. Yeah, but it's nice to think of that. And today I was thinking about forests. There are forests in Kurangai Tuku, but they don't, they're not as prominent as maybe her cave. And this book has a lot of forest in it at the moment. So there's the forest and the gathering in one of my chapters. And this week I've been writing about Lost Forests, which was that strange Australian store that was on Queen Street in Auckland when I was young. And I'd go up there and look at all these soft toys. I probably should describe it because it doesn't exist anymore. And I believe it doesn't exist in the world anymore as well. So it was like a room that was painted like a forest, and there were plastic trees, basically. And from the trees, there'd be soft toys hanging from them, sort of possum-y looking things. Mm. And the trees would whisper. The trees would tell stories. So it was a really trippy place. And yeah, I used to visit it a lot when I was a teenager, like walking down Queen Street, because there was a frozen yogurt place somewhere near there too, which I really liked, mainly because the guy at the frozen yogurt place is so grumpy all the time. If you're listening to this frozen yogurt guy, I understand why now.
Now we get it.
I get it. But at the time, I was like, why are you so grumpy? I just want frozen yogurt, man.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Oh my Memories. Yeah, because it was funny because it wasn't until you mentioned that shop the other week that I remembered going to one. And so, and I honestly thought that that was a dream I'd had. And when you said it existed, I was just like, oh my goodness.
It is sort of like a fever dream.
Yeah, it really was a strange place.
It was a very strange
because,
place.
Because, yeah, you would virtually, it was almost like, it was in those days where you like adopted Cabbage Patch Kids and stuff. Yeah. Like, it felt like, yeah, like the animals were there and you kind of, you know, took them home, and which was very strange.
The trees were telling the story of
the trees. The trees were very much whispering. Yeah. I remember that quite a lot. It's like, sorry, I'm just going, I don't know. There was this place in, like, my grandmother used to take me to morning to tea, to like cafe tea, which in those days was a coffee shop when you got an egg sandwich.
Oh, nice.
But like, there was this place, I'm sure it was on the top of Farmers, that had a tree in the middle, and like it was this very strange place. And I'm not sure if I'm remembering it. Maybe I'm getting the Lost Forest mixed up. Anyway, yeah, weird places.
I hope it exists.
I hope it exists. I really hope it exists.
You can write it in a novel and then it will exist.
Yeah, then it will exist. I really like this idea of like having, and that's kind of, I mean, I guess that's what I find interesting about the stage that your work is up to. The blank page of this book is not that
blank
far
page.
Away. Yeah. Like, and I'm just wondering, what does a work day look like in these really generative months? Like these months where you're going from nothing being there to, oh my goodness, you know, like I want something to be there. I just wonder what your work, I don't know, your work hours? I don't know, like what do you do during the day? Yeah. What does it look like, that generative kind of part of the book project?
I work in the mornings because I know me and I will make any excuse if I don't get onto something straight away.
Yep.
So I work in the mornings and then I don't have any excuse. I'm starting work and I'm doing it. And when I first started in July, like I regard writing almost like physical training.
Nice.
Because it is surprisingly physical work, which sounds bizarre, but it is. Anyway, so I started off with like a very low daily word count. And I like to have a goal. So that's, I put a word count, a daily word count on my program so I know where I am with it. So I started off quite low and I've built up. At the moment I'm writing about 1,200 words a day and I only work Mondays to Fridays. So give myself the weekend to blob at the moment, just sleep. But yeah, I try to turn up every day and put in however many hours that takes. At the moment, she says, and again, looking for wood, at the moment I'm usually done by about 11 in the morning.
Yeah.
But I know in the past, when I've been writing other novels, sometimes it takes all day.
Yeah.
All day to get there.
Yeah.
And just being kind to myself, going, okay, it's not because you're lazy or stupid. It is hard work sometimes doing it. So, yeah. I also kind of give myself the freedom, and I say this to my students as well, give myself the freedom to write a really shitty first draft.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the chapter I've been working on at the moment falls in and out of tenses. Sometimes it's in the past, sometimes it's in the present, sometimes it's that in one sentence. I'm pretty sure I have talked about dock boots too much and the making of tea and coffee far too much. But yeah, that's future fitty, second draft fitty's problem.
Yeah.
At the moment I'm just getting words down. And at the moment I'm feeling really lucky that it's coming quite easily at the moment. Yeah.
This is an amazing idea. Like, I haven't heard of this before, and I really like it, this idea of building up. Like, because I think it can be quite daunting to say we're going to do 2,000 words today.
Yeah.
You know, on day one, you know, when you don't know anybody and you don't know the place and that kind of thing, yeah.
And that's a nice thing. I think I gave myself, like, maybe 500 words to start with. Probably could have even done 300 words.
Mm-mm.
So for the first week, 2 weeks, it was done in half an hour.
Nice.
But I also, like, let myself have that win. So instead of just kind of pushing through further, it's like, no, you've done it. Yay, let's go do whatever else you want to do now.
Yeah.
Read a book, you know, go to work, that kind of thing. So, yeah, I think it helps. It's helped me. I've done this now for the past couple of novels, that to recognise that it does take a while to get back into the flow of writing. But once I'm there, it's fine.
Yeah.
But yeah, I do have an upper limit. Like, I can't really write past 1,600 words.
Yeah.
Beyond that, I'm just done.
Yeah, yeah.
And I can't work for, a couple of days after that.
Yeah, yeah.
So it makes more sense for me to write shorter and then write every day than it does to have a really great one day when I put out, like, 3,000 words or whatever it might be, and then be useless for the next 2 weeks.
So you will stop when you reach that, like...
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that sounds like a great idea
If I'm, like, hot, I've got all these ideas floating around, then I'll spend a little time and I'll write myself notes about what I was thinking and where I was going to go. Like, if I've got a really clear idea of where the next kind of dramatic action is going to happen, then I'll write, like, the bullet points of where I was thinking, what was happening, which is great because then the next day I've already got a thing there. And also I try to stop not at the end of a sequence.
Yep.
So I've still got a little bit of warming up when I get back to the desk. If I can. If I can't, then the first hour I'm cursing myself or just pacing up and down my, what happens next? I don't know.
It is really interesting. And then what I really like as well about it is that it sounds like the rest of the day, like, what's the right word I'm looking for? Like, this is what I recognize, so it might not be exactly what's happening, but sometimes it's really nice to let my subconscious chew on it while I'm doing other things, if you know what I mean. Like, it's not, I finish and then we'll walk away and do the other things of life. And I sort of see that as giving the book a bit of space to, you know, find itself out, kind of.
Yeah. And I've found that my characters as well, that gives them time to tell me things.
Yeah, yeah.
Like this morning, so my protagonist is called Aria. She's the artist that we'll talk about in the rest of the book, obviously. The book is about her. But I found out this morning that she's going to dye all her clothes black because she's decided she's goth.
Nice.
She's 14 at the moment in this chapter. So she's, dyeing all her clothes.
I like that a lot.
And I didn't realise that about her until today. But she's like, no, this is what I'm doing. I'm dyeing all my clothes today.
Oh, my gosh, that is so great. And I think, I don't know, like it just, I don't know. I really like the idea of the freedom to, do you read when you're writing?
Yes.
And do you read for the project or do you let anything come in that sort of comes in?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, a bit of both. I haven't read a lot the past couple of weeks. I don't know why, just I haven't. But yeah, I try to let things come to me, but as I'm also seeking out things as well. So because I'm trying to write, or I am writing, we shall decide, a horror. This is basically a horror. It's a ghost story. I'm seeking out those kind of stories.
Yeah.
To read, to model on.
Yeah.
Or not to model on. I like to read things that are bad for me as well as things that are good for me, in a way. So, yeah, if I hate a book, I'm analysing why I hate it and then trying not to fall into those same traps.
Yeah. There's something really beautiful about the gift of a book that I don't gel with. There's something really, it's one of the, I really always feel grateful for that because it does one of two things. It either shows me what I'm not after or it kind of challenges me for what I am after, if you know what I mean. Like it's like, oh, why do you want to do it that way, you know? Yeah. And I imagine, and horror is quite a broad church, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like it's church.
But it's not a Christian horror.
I was just thinking, Bo was watching that really full-on one that's got a church at the centre of it. I watched it. And all the cats wash up on the shore. Can't remember. Anyway,
I might have to look that
You might have to look it up. I can't remember what it's called, but I will remember. Can I ask what draws you to that genre? What interests you about that genre?
I started writing horror as a young tot.
Oh, right.
As a young wee lass. I think, I don't know why, I think that's, maybe I was reading lots of Roald Dahl when I was like little.
Oh, of course.
And that kind of turned into I'm going to write horror stories.
Yeah.
It's kind of funny because I was thinking recently about it because my story Cicada was published in Hiwa recently. And that story is about a writer and their younger self, and it is horror-esque. But in that story, it talks about the story that I did write when I was 11, called The Story of Great Importance, because I was very confident as a writer when I was 11.
Jesus.
Not anymore. Don't know where that has gone.
Your younger self.
But at 11,
better.
I was like, I am the greatest writer ever. I wrote this story, and it was about an older woman who was sucking the youth from a young girl, basically.
Love
I can't really remember it, and I don't know where there are any copies. But it was published, in the Taupo Times.
Awesome.
So it was the first thing I was that I had published. So I sort of wrote Cicada as an homage to that as well.
Nice.
But yeah, that's, I guess, where the horror thing has come from. So almost like going back to my roots, but also thinking about Kurungai Tuku as a character. She's scary.
Yeah.
She's scary.
Yeah.
And when I was writing Kurungai Tuku itself, part of the reason why I'm writing this novel and the next novel is because I was trying to shove these other two novels within Kurungai Tuku and they didn't really fit because they are quite different novels. So, as I said, this is part of my PhD, so I had a meeting with my supervisors, and one of my supervisors, Tom, said, oh, this is quite different from Kurungai Tuku, it's quite realist. And I said, yes, apart from, the giant bird woman, it is quite realist. But yeah, it is quite different in tone. I want to say contemporary, but it's set in the 80s and 90s, so,
yeah.
I mean, that was a long time ago now, showing my age.
I feel old.
It's a historical novel now.
That's really good.
Sorry.
No, it really is.
It really is.
No, I'm laughing.
It's last century. So, yeah. In a way, it's writing horror is coming back to that, and it's sort of honouring Kurungai Tuku in a way too.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. But yeah.
It's an exceptionally cool genre, I think, because it just, it is, there's some fancy word for that kind of literature, but it really does do things bodily to the reader.
Yeah.
I think it's transmutation? There's a name for it, yeah, yeah.
Oh, like trans-substance.
Yeah, is that it? I can't remember what it is.
Sorry,
yeah,
Catholics.
Yeah.
You know what I mean.
You know what we mean. But yeah, I feel like this kind of writing really does make, like, you feel a bodily change quite physically with it.
And I like that.
Me too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, I remember reading House of Leaves for the first time and just being, and just having that, I had to check over my shoulder a couple of times. Just that feeling of, And it's not the gore of it's that creeping kind of feeling, which I like. And I feel like, I don't know, when I was talking to my other supervisor, Robert Sullivan, about it being a ghost story, and because we were talking about it from a te ao Māori perspective, he was like, so it's just an everyday story then. Mm. So yeah, in a way that horror, I guess, the Western idea of horror kind of fits in with how I see the world almost.
Mm.
Like, there are things that need to be respected, things that you see at the corner of your eye that you should be wary of, that I think te ao Māori does a good job of acknowledging, whereas we need to, like, hype it up almost in our modern Western way of looking at things. So we need those jump scares, whereas maybe they were slowly creeping up on us all along in te ao Māori. I don't know. I just made that up.
I love it. I also think, I don't know, like, I'm always interested what writing can do that other media can't do.
Mm.
And I think that one of the things writing has is that metaphor where one thing is two things at once. Like, you can kind of do it with special effects photography, but that feeling where you see someone and you think it's someone and then they switch and they're not that person, you know, like, it's like, oh, it's my Uncle Jim. Oh, no, it's some stranger. I don't have an Uncle Jim, but, like, I think that writing can do that in a very, very kind of way. And like you say, with something like House of Leaves, it definitely isn't the gore. And like Shirley Jackson as well.
Yeah.
Like, it's not that someone's arm's fallen off and there's a graphic description of that. Although sometimes it is. Like, I'm all for that as well. Like, I like a good visceral kind of body horror as well. But I think so often it's that creeping atmosphere and that, oh, it's nice to be frightened, eh?
Yeah.
I quite like it.
I think it reminds you of being alive.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're alive, yay, celebrate that.
Yeah,
because you've just scared yourself silly. and, you know, some parts of my life have been kind of really scary. Like, I used to live at the fever hospital.
Oh, wow, crikey.
Yeah. I used to live at the fever hospital, which, if you're not in Wellington.
Very energetically busy place.
Yes. There's this old hospital that they built in the early 1900s to house all the influenza and TB at later stage patients. And it's sort of in a dell at the top of Mount Vic. So you can't really see it from the road and you can't really see it on the mountain itself until you're actually upon it. And now it's got SPCA in it and it's a beautiful place. So if you're ever at the SPCA, I used to live where the puppies are now. Yeah, that was my wing. I used to live down there. So we had wings that we lived in, the huge buildings, and it was a semi-squatting situation. We were there partly to keep the building in good order because people were would have parties and destroy places of it. But I'll tell a ghost story.
I like a ghost story.
So one night I had this. Where I slept then was near a morgue. An old morgue where they'd put the bodies to be picked up and taken back into town, I guess, for burial. So, yeah, already a little bit creepy. So it's in one of the old wings. And I had a really vivid dream. So if you go out of each of the wards, there's a long corridor that connects all of the wards that you look right down and you can see. So I had this dream that I walked out of my room and I was looking down this corridor and there was an old man at the end of the corridor looking at me. And I was like, oh, what are you doing here? And then it did that scary horror thing where you blink and they've come,
oh my Lord,
come forward. And yeah, I'm like, oh my God. Woke up, was, oh my God, that was freaky. Then I was having breakfast the next morning and talking to Fee, who lived in the ward next to me, telling her, like, I had this weird dream last night, telling her about this dream. She's like, I had the same dream.
Oh no.
So we had the same dream and yeah, it was freaky.
Oh my Lord.
Yeah, and actual scary things happened there that weren't supernatural. Or ghosty in any way.
Yeah.
Once, this is going to be horrible. I'm sorry. This is a domestic violence warning, so you can skip over it if you need to. But once we were there, just chilling out in the big kind of hall where we would all gather and watch things or listen to music, and there was a knock on the door, which is odd because no one comes to visit that place.
Yeah, yeah.
Unless we'd invited them and we'd know that people are coming. So we went to answer the door and there was a woman there and she was like covered in blood. And apparently her boyfriend had taken her up to the top of Mount Vic and stabbed her.
Oh man.
And then pushed her down the hill and thought, you know,
yeah,
there's no one there to help her. She'll, yeah, but we were there to help her. So
thank goodness.
That was really scary.
Because that's the thing that I do think is exceptionally interesting in horror. And I think it's interesting, I've read kind of articles about why sort of like female presenting people are the most interested in true crime and, you know, and I think it is that really interesting thing where there's something about horror and art where it's contained, whereas for a lot of people their lives are horrific and, you know, things could come from anywhere kind of thing. And I think that ability to kind of experience fear in a controlled way is kind of an interesting you know what I mean? You know, like,
it's,
I don't know.
Cathartic almost, I guess.
Yeah, cathartic. That's a really good word, actually. Yeah, like it's a way to kind of, I don't know, like, I do, because I think you're, you know, I think there is something interesting between like what we'd consider horror and sort of supernatural and those kind of stories and then the, and then the real life horror. I think they talk to each other in quite an interesting way.
Yeah, and I'm really interested in this novel. I'm hoping I can pull this off. We shall see. It's early days yet, but I'm hoping that we have this character, Kurungai Tuku, who's a, for a better word, she's a monster. So you'd expect the horror to live there.
Mm.
But really I would like the real life terrible things that happen to Aria to be the actual horror.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's that kind of, yeah, we seek the supernatural horror.
Mm.
It's almost safer than facing what we have in our actual lives, which that's a bit sad, isn't it?
But I think is it Intan Paramathama? Someone that I talked to wrote these incredible books, and also I forgot her name, in Christchurch, and this idea of the sort of monstrous feminine as well, you know, like this idea that some of the things we've been told are monstrous about ourselves, or, you know, that gaslighting that goes on, you know, like she's shrill, she's this, she's, you know, that kind of stuff. I think it's really interesting, and that's what I think is so fucking beautiful about Kurungai Tuku, is the way that there's a revisiting of the idea of the monster, like who is the monster in the room kind of stuff, which I think is just so successful in that book.
Oh, thank you. And that, I worked hard at that.
Yeah. thank you for working hard, because that's what I think is interesting about what you're saying about this book, is that, like, I think I said to you the other day, I'm so excited about this idea of, you know, like rereading Kurungai Tuku and anticipate, do you know what I mean? Like, what I'm hoping is that I can time it exactly right so that I can finish that and start the new one. But yeah, I guess that is such an interesting thing, because I guess you're in this interesting stage where you're sort of, you know, generative in this book, but also halfway through kind of a bigger project as well, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah, and I kind of didn't when I started Kurungai Tuku, I didn't set out to write three books because who does? I mean, I know lots of people do. I know lots of people do, but I don't because I'm lazy.
Yeah, I'm lazy too.
So I didn't really set out with that, but by the time it came to polishing Kurungai Tuku, by the time I'd pulled out these pieces that are now this novel and the next novel, I was putting in sort of references that I could pick up later. So a while ago I was talking to someone about Taneko and how you make the patterns by carrying colour behind, and then when you need that colour to make the pattern, you twist that colour up to make that colour. So that's how I'm thinking of these threads that I've left in Kurungai Tuku. I'm picking them up again and twisting them into this new pattern. So there's callbacks, I guess, to the book. I don't know why I keep saying it's not a sequel, but I really can't think of it as a sequel. Yes, it happens sort of later on in our concept of time, but it almost exists at the same time for Kurungai Tuku in particular. Mm.
I love that idea.
Yeah.
Because I think that thing, that of course that's another wonderful thing about all your a lot of your writing, is that play with time and that challenge to linear time.
Yeah, maybe I just have a difficulty with the concept of time as a normal linear thing.
Well, the Western patriarchal concept of time, maybe. I don't know. I think that it is a real joy to read your books in that way, is that they do kind of open the mind to... I can sort of read theory about concepts of time, you know, like maybe time's like this, maybe time's like that. But when I read your books, I can kind of settle into that experience. Like I can sort of think, oh, yeah, this also is time, you know, this also is time.
And I guess with Kurungai Tuku in this book and the next book, I am consciously playing with the idea of time through a more te ao Māori kind of idea of time, and that... Yeah, when you're in a whare nui and you're looking around, you're told the stories as if they're happening.
Yeah.
So I think that's why I'm struggling a little bit at the moment with past tense or present tense in this novel, because is each chapter happening? Like, she's looking at the art and that's what kind of triggers the story. So is each story happening in present time or not? So that's something I'll have to, think about as a writer. Well, second draft Fitty,
hello in the future. right here.
Yeah, I'll listen to this when I'm second draft Fitty and go, curse you, first draft Fitty.
Curse you.
Do your work. Make a decision, goddamn you.
But, I mean, it is, I don't know, what keeps coming to me when you're saying things, I've just read... an amazing, amazing. I think I can say this. I just read this amazing work about Baisora and Korean literature and Korean language. You know, writing in Korean, and I do think English can be a pretty tricky. And you, as a person, you know, you're learning more than one, you know, more than two languages, more than three languages at the moment, more than four languages at the moment. I just, you know, English can be a bit tricky sometimes, eh?
Yeah.
I sometimes just am hanging out for some of those verbs at the end, Germanic languages.
Of like that, though, those kind of weird limitations. It's going back to the object sort of idea and Kurungai Tuku, the big idea of flipping the book was because I wanted to push how far the object of a novel could be.
Yeah.
So in some ways, thinking about how far can you push
English,
language.
Yeah.
Yeah. How far can I push? I mean, I was pretty, silly? No, I don't know what the word is. When I was pushing my limited te reo Māori in Kurungai Tuku, and I should shout out my te reo Māori editors again for smoothing those very terrible attempts. But I was trying to push the playfulness, I guess, of it, because learning, particularly learning te reo Māori, has a whole bunch of emotional baggage with it for me, and a lot of learners too. So I'm a bit afraid of it, of like failing at it or like saying the wrong thing. So me sprinkling te reo Māori words through it, and like I make a pun in one bit that is a pun on Hiriaka. So it's, I think it talks about the aka and the aka, so the gentle and the binding. Which I had to explain to the te reo Māori editors, because I've shoved this language in with the English to try and play with it a bit, to free my mind. Push English a little bit more. I'm experimenting with this novel. I want to use Mihi Manurere, which is like a beautiful love song. But if you take it line by line and out of context, it's really quite creepy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I'm kind of experimenting with that at the moment as like epigraphs, I guess. And I had an idea ages ago, so I might use it for this one, of having the te reo Māori and then an English translation under it. And the English translation is not quite right.
Mm-hmm.
It sort of means the same thing, but not quite. Just to have that sort of gap, which I'm, again, gaps and gutters and pushing boundaries and language. It's all very exciting at this end.
I really love it. I really love it. And, like, I guess, one of the things I'm interested in is that this book doesn't exist at the moment.
No. Half of it does.
Yeah, half of it does. And I just wonder, how does it sit in, do you think, do you allow yourself to think about the finished project, the finished thing?
Mm.
And if it does, how does it, I mean, like I was just thinking for me, sometimes it's just a feeling, if you know what I mean. Like I never think about covers or, you know, fonts or anything like that, or holding it or anything like that. But it has a certain feeling that I take with me everywhere. And I just wonder, how do you sort of, do you allow yourself to think about the finished object? And second, how do you visualise it or imagine it?
Mm. At this stage, I'm not thinking about the finished object, but I do at some stage, because I love talking about that with the design team.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
It's like, oh, I've got this really cool idea.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking a little bit about font, because I'm wanting to use page design to show, is this a spoiler? Maybe, I don't know.
Should we say to show an element of the story or something?
Thank you, that's good.
Yeah, let's use that,
So I'm trying to use the font to show the progress of an element of a story through the story. So I'm thinking a little bit about that now.
Yeah.
Not in terms of I want this font and I want that font, but how can I use that to show this part of the story?
Yeah.
Visually and almost subconsciously.
Yeah.
I would really like it for the reader to reach some point and go, hang on.
Yeah, yeah. I love that.
And then flip back and go, oh, yeah, that's been happening all along, but I didn't notice it. It's, again, it's that kind of creeping feeling.
Oh, my gosh.
But the actual object itself, not really, although I am thinking at the moment of, like, the pieces of art, just because some of them I'm thinking, is that actually physically possible
to make that? Yeah.
Not that I want them in my house, because I know what they what they are. So, yeah. And sometimes I'm like, again, this is the person, the frustrated person that didn't go to art school. Wouldn't it be cool to have, like, my book launch in, like, an exhibition space with all the paintings around?
Oh, Fatty, that would be amazing.
Don't encourage me.
I'd go to that.
Don't encourage me. I need to sleep at some stage.
You know I always encourage you. Oh, my God, that would be amazing.
My highfalutin ideas.
Highfalutin. They're not highfalutin. They're bloody fantastic. They're part of what makes the world amazing. I was wondering a little bit about timelines. Like, doing it as part of the PhD kind of factors in a timeline of sorts. Like, I mean, I've had a lot of friends that have, you know, done the PhD and the novels set differently, you know, earlier or later than the PhD finishing. But I just wonder, is that something you allow yourself to think about at this time? Like, do you set yourself deadlines?
Yeah, I try to. Mm. Obviously, that didn't work with Kurungai Tuku because that went on for years and years and years. But yeah, I try to. So yeah, having the PhD structure around it is helping with that.
Yeah, yeah.
But also, I've been sitting on this story for a while now.
Yeah.
And like, I was going to start it last year, but you know, great things happened in my life, and I was too busy to start it. So yeah, I was kind of rearing to go now. Mm, mm. So I'm trying to get a first draft done. Now that I say it out loud on a podcast, is that dooming me to not do it? But I'm trying to get it done before I start teaching again next semester.
Nice, nice.
To get a good first draft out, or finished, I guess, by about March would be ideal for me. And then I can, like, let it rest for a while and think about it. And so hopefully second draft fitty has got a clearer head to do it. But also there's another, like, another novel waiting in the wings.
Mm, mm,
and also a novella that I'd quite like to cheat on my novel with.
Very important.
So, yeah, timelines have become really important
yeah.
in that way. But they always have. Like, I really like a deadline. I like to have a goal. Like I was saying before, I have daily word goals. So I like to have something to aim towards. Just helps, particularly when I'm feeling like I can't do it and all the kind of imposter syndrome ideas of, like, you're a terrible writer, no one's going to read this. Just focusing on getting the work done.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Helps.
Yeah, yeah, I really like that. One thing I would be interested in asking you is around like these other things. You know, you've mentioned Hiwa, you've mentioned, you know, like there have been in the Shelter book, you know, like there have been these amazing works that are kind of around it, and this idea of the novella, and I don't know, like, I've always thought it's quite nice to finish some things sometimes. Like, a novel is such a long-term thing that sometimes it's really nice to just have a bit of an interruption to finish something. And that's the other thing I loved about the PhD, was that there's scope to work on a critical piece as well. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Like, they sort of feed each other in this really great way. And I don't know, like... yeah, like, so do you keep yourself open to, like, if someone says to you and commissions something, you...
Yeah, yeah. At the moment the books are closed.
everyone?
Everyone, the books are closed for the moment because I'm working on a collaboration with my cousin Piata.
Oh, of course, yeah, yeah,
so Piata, my cousin Piata Larkin, is a visual artist. She has some amazing works around Auckland, particularly public works around Auckland, so check her out, she's amazing. But, yeah, I'm collaborating with her on a book which is part of the Kōrero series, which Massey University is putting out. So, yeah, at the moment that project is with her.
Yep.
So we're trying to do, I wrote the first part of the story. She's going to draw some pictures responding to that and for the next part, and then I'll respond to her pictures in the next part. So we're trying to do it quite... collaboratively rather than me just writing a story and her illustrating it. So, yeah, that's a nice kind of break away from that. But it also kind of feeds into this as well, because that's all about, it's the idea is about coming home, and we've interpreted that as the te reo Māori journey. Yeah, so, yeah, playing with language again and what the limits are of that. And, yeah, being quite vulnerable with that as well. And also because it's a shorter piece, at the moment I'm writing it in second person, which is very difficult to do. But I felt like I could have written it in first person, but I feel like the second writing in second opens it up more, even though I'm being quite specific about, like, the mountains and the whakapapa of the you. It feels more open than if I was just telling it through me, because I don't want it to just be a story about me, because obviously it's not a story that me and my cousin are creating. But I think it's an important discussion to have about reo, particularly as adult learners, and the kind of whakamā around there and the maimai around reacquiring your language.
Mm.
So, yeah, I wanted to have it opened up a little bit in that. And next year I'm going to Berlin. Exciting to do, to look at some objects, choose an object from a collection and write a story about that. So, yeah, and I think that will all feed into this idea as well. But I don't know how yet.
Because it is, I really, sorry, did I interrupt you?
No.
Oh, sweet. no social skills. But yeah, I think this is what's really interesting, eh? Like when the writing has started, this is my experience, everything becomes the writing. Like whether it's doing the dishes, whether it's walking down the street, whether it's going to Berlin, whether it's, you know, it feels like, it sets something in motion that is like this sort of living thing that will find sustenance in lots of, you know, whatever I'm doing, it'll find sustenance, maybe because it's kind of being channeled through me or that kind of thing. So I really like this idea of, you know, like trying to stay open to things because I know, you know, I think I had this idea that writers were like alone and you know, like no one worried them but bought them food every morning and every night.
That'd be amazing.
That'd be really nice. But yeah, I think that this this being in the world kind of feeds into the work as well.
Yeah.
I think that.
I think as writers, I should probably not speak for all writers. I'm speaking for myself. As a writer, I'm a passion seeker.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So
yeah,
if I'm open to the word, things are going to feed into my work because I'm looking for those connections all the time around me. What is this? Oh, blah, blah, blah. Like I was saying like earlier this week to you that the chapter about the gathering, I think, came out of me reading your work, reading an audition.
Oh, yeah.
And thinking about how an audition, you should read that book, it's amazing. Audition by Pip Adam, out now. At your best bookstores around.
And the worst. And also at the worst booksellers.
At all booksellers. Anyway, so yeah, your focus on sound and how that moves both people and the ship audition. I think I was reading it and then the next morning the memory of being at the gathering in the Happy Hardcore tent, looking at the mud being moved by the speakers, was so strong that I was like, she's at the gathering and I'm going to write this thing. And it's that chapter's opened up the novel. And I don't know if it would have happened if I hadn't read your book or hadn't been open to that.
Mm.
Because I did have some like really strong, I guess, ideas of where this novel was going to be. Mm. Like, I hadn't outlined it or anything yet, but I was like, this is what happens and this is what happens. But I think this novel was stronger because I was like, this is new, but let's see where it goes.
Mm-hmm. I love that.
Like it's telling me itself almost.
Yeah. And like for it to tell us, I feel like we do need to, yeah. Like I have, there are some writers I can't read while I'm writing.
Oh.
But yeah, I think, because I just end up copying them. But yeah, I think that it is, I don't know, I think that it is really good. We're almost finished.
Oh, and no.
I've got two questions to ask you. This has been such a great conversation. I'm totally starting this series because I'm stuck in my own writing.
Like, oh, okay.
Yeah, I'm
yeah,
like,
fair enough.
How does everyone else do it? Tell me now.
That's a good idea.
And you've been incredibly generous.
That's like, such a good idea, Pip. I'm going to start a podcast.
Yeah, start a podcast.
No, I'm not.
Here. Yeah, no, go on. But yeah, I guess the two last questions I've got are kind of intertwined.
Mm.
One of them is about how you sustain yourself at this stage of the project, and the other one is about financially sustaining yourself, because I love the money.
Yeah,
I love the money. But yeah, first of all, I guess my first question is, how do you keep yourself going?
Yep.
And I mean, you've talked, I think this idea of word limit is, I've never heard it used people talk about it in such an articulate way as you have. But I just wonder what does sustain you at this point? Like you talked about even buying yourself, you know, getting yourself a present.
Treat yourself. What sustains me? I think sometimes it's just stubbornness.
Yeah.
That sustains me. No, that's a terrible facetious thing to say. What does sustain me? Now I'm stumped.
Yeah, I don't know. Like I was wondering, like, I mean, and I think, I guess like this turning up every day is quite incredible. If you think about it, like I think that sometimes we take it a bit for granted. Well, I take it for granted. I'm like, oh, I turn up every day. But
once
like,
I get into habits though, it's quite
easy. So the habit is helpful.
Yeah. Right. Habit is helpful. It's also helpful for me. I don't know. This might be a bit like huggy, touchy-feely.
You're in the right place.
Watching.
With me.
Just hug it out.
Yeah.
to think about what the heart of the story is.
Yeah.
Like what am I actually writing about?
Yeah. Yeah.
And sometimes that's not anyone else's business.
Yeah, exactly.
Apart from yours. But yeah, it's like in the doldrums, when the albatross is around your neck, how much Rome of the Ancient Mariner can I shove into this?
Yeah, go on.
But yeah, when you're in the doldrums, just thinking, why?
Yeah.
What was that initial impulse to write this? What was it? Just to hold on to that.
Yeah.
Chocolate,
very important.
Bribing yourself.
I love that idea of holding on to what it is. I remember, a friend saying, writing kind of where it's grounded. What is this grounded in? Which I think is really good as well.
Mm.
I love that idea. But yes, chocolate, important. Chocolate.
And when I first started writing plays, so I was in a group and Hone Koko was facilitating it.
Yeah.
And every time we'd all share our scenes and things, and every time he'd say, why this and why now? And sometimes that helps as well.
Yeah.
To remind me why I'm here. It's like, why am I writing this? Oh, that's right. It's because of blah, 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 whatever it might be. So, yeah, I think that sustains me. Also, what I've been doing with this, I've changed up my practice a little bit. So I was talking to Ruby Solly when Kurungai Tuku came out, and she said, what did you do to protect yourself from Kurungai Tuku? And I was like, ooh, yeah, that would have been a good idea.
Yeah.
So for this, I have a karakia that I say at the beginning and at the end.
Mm.
Sometimes I've been a candle at the same time, so it smells nice in my room. But making a conscious step that I'm in this time of writing now.
Mm.
And making sure I close that off. I mean, I'm still going to think about it in
life,
obviously, but just to have that sort of space, I've given myself the space to work in. I think that's helping sustain me too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I really love that idea of sort of noir and, because I think often we do have to... Like, I feel like sometimes I have to really open myself up quite energetic. Sorry, I keep using that word, but you know what I mean? Like, I have to open myself.
Like this, emotionally, psychologically. How, like, emotionally taxing it's been. And I'm like, of course it is, Fiddy. It's like a really emotional thing. What did you think was going to happen? But to have that sort of structure I'm going to fuck a gnaw afterwards.
Yep.
And I tend to work in my pyjamas. Like, I get up, like, literally get up from bed, and that's the first thing I do.
Yeah.
That's right. So I could be in my pyjamas at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. Don't judge. But
it's your work uniform.
It's my work uniform. I can't think in tight pants.
Exactly.
It's just not going to happen. But also sort of the process of fucking gnaw afterwards is like having a shower.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just letting it wash away from me.
Yeah.
Eating. I'm starving.
Yeah, I can imagine.
All right. So, eating. So, coming back to the earth. I think that's that. Like being kind to myself, which I wasn't very good at when I first began writing, and now I'm make that a priority.
Mm.
Yeah,
I love that. Thank you so much.
And the other one was financial.
Oh yeah, money. You don't have to talk about money. Some people don't
it's
like.
Right.
To.
No,
I'm really rude. I come from a family that. Yeah, I'm sorry.
I don't mind talking about money.
Yeah.
At the moment, I'm very lucky because it's part of my job.
Fantastic.
To write. It's part of my research time. as an academic. So I'm very lucky in that way. But in the past, it's been part of the reason why Kurangai Toku took so long is because I was trying to feed myself during that time. So I was taking other jobs, which took away time from writing. And I guess that's just the reality of of writing in the society at this moment.
Mm.
I don't think it's the reality for all time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but at the moment that's the reality here.
Yeah.
So yeah, grants and whatnot would buy me a little bit of time in applying for all residencies and things.
Yeah.
Just have the time and the stipend which would pay my rent or my mortgage or feed me.
Mm.
But yeah, those have been how I've made work in the past.
Mm.
Just like cobbling bits of money and time together to get it out.
And I think for me there's a lot of, you know, like I can sort of slip sometimes into a victim mentality where I'm just like, but I think sometimes there's advantage in the stop-start for me. Like or trying to, I don't know what the right word is, but almost trying to ride the wave of the stop-start, you know. I think I'm getting better at that, like sort of, you know, like,
And that might give you time to see things again.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, that's what I used to tell myself. I don't know if that's true.
Well, I think if we stay positive.
Yeah.
Like someone called me toxically positive yesterday.
Oh, really?
But which I think I was being. I was like, the chairs and tables and miracles too. Everything will be fine. Let's just play this violin and waltz around.
No,
but, yeah.
The podcast people did not see us just dancing around.
Yeah, that was, we both did the
same
motion.
We both
did
the same motion.
We must, like, jigged. We jigged. There's no other word for that.
Yeah.
We jigged. Thank you so much, Futi.
Kia ora.
I really appreciate it. And, yeah, can't wait, like, maybe we'll talk to you in another year.
That would be great.
Oh, my gosh.
I always have time to talk to you, Pip.
Oh, I'm very grateful. Thank you so much.
Thank you.